Good morning and hello everybody, and welcome to another Belfast Men's Health Group podcast. And today, and it's not in the studio, it's over a telephone line, I have Dr. Philip McGarry, who is a consultant psychiatrist, who, although is retired, is still associated with Belfast Trust and is doing a number of sessions per week. So Philip, thank you very much for being willing to take part in this podcast.
I'm happy to be part of it too. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much indeed, Philip. So Philip, what we're going to do is just ask you a number of questions about how you got into medicine, COVID-19, any mental health impacts, and where we take it from there. So if I could kick off with the first question is, could you tell us a little bit about your background yourself and why you became interested in medicine and actually ended up as a psychiatrist?
Well, my father was in fact a surgeon. So psychiatry and medicine is about as far away as you could be from surgery. But then my hands weren't terribly steady, and I was never really terribly good with my hands at making things. And also at school, my two favourite subjects were English and history. In fact, I did A-level English and didn't do A-level biology at school. Having said that, I still was quite impressed with what my father was doing. My mother was a nurse, and she met him when she was a nurse. The matter, he was a junior doctor, and that moved me on to do medicine. And then in final year at medicine, I went to Holywell Hospital in Antrim, thinking, well, it'll be a quiet month, I can study for finals. But by the end of that month, I knew I wanted to do psychiatry. And I suppose one of the big things about it was a sense of listening to people telling their story. And that was absolutely fascinating, because in the rest of medicine, yes, of course, you'd ask a little bit about themselves and their background, but it's very much based upon the physical examination. But in psychiatry, you could sit for, I remember as a student spending about 2 hours with a young woman who was very warm and chatty and engaging. We talked, but was on television the night before. But at the very end, it became clear that she did have a very severe delusional disorder. I find that really, really fascinating. And then I'm back to general medicine, and some of my other students said, "Oh, Mrs. Smith, she is the woman in the fourth bay with the gallbladder," and that really contrasted with what I've been doing, which is just listening to people's stories. So that's really what moved me on to psychiatry. I liked the fact I wasn't much good with my hands.
Okay, well, that's an interesting angle how you approached it. You've been involved in the health service for a long time. What were your main areas that you were involved with in the health service? And secondly, were there differences in how men and women appeared to you as patients and clients? And what I'm trying to get at, were they referred more easily to you, or was it difficult getting men to refer themselves? So the question, two parts: what were you involved with in terms of psychiatry, and the differences between men and women coming in into your line of care?
Well, I've always been a general adult psychiatrist based upon those aged 18 and upwards. Yeah. I started off it was then called Perdisburn, became Knockbracken in 1993. And then I moved to Mater in 1999. I was the general psychiatrist for the West Belfast area, but also then did liaison sessions in the Royal Victoria Hospital for many years. And then in 2007, I moved to home treatment. And this is quite a new development at that time. But in fact, I think it very much blazed a trail for medicine as a whole, because until home treatment started, I maybe could see, along with maybe the nurses, see a patient maybe who was unwell, maybe 2, 3, maximum 4 times in a week, between 9 to 5. If we couldn't cope with that, the only alternative was hospital. Home treatment developed in the early 2000s in England and came here by 2005. And most people, if offered the option, would you rather be treated at home with a nurse calling your house 7 days a week, 365 days a year, maybe even twice in the day if necessary, on the phone throughout the day if necessary, would you rather have that than being in the psychiatric ward? most people and their relatives, including really severely ill people, preferred to be treated at home. So it very much led the way for managing people at home. And we're finding in general medicine now, in fact, there's a similar trend. Don't bring in people into hospital unless you have to. They have to come in, then they have to come in, and you want to make it a really, really good and excellent environment. But if you can treat people in their own home, that's a much better option. And that really was spent the last 12 years of my career. In terms of your question about men and women, yes, I mean, it's quite interesting that women, for example, traditionally been seen having a higher rate of depression than men, but they're more likely to come forward for treatment. On the other hand, men, sadly, are three times as likely to take their own life, and in many cases, they won't have sought treatment. Another case of perhaps alcohol, again, alcohol problems are more prominent in men, although that balance is becoming much closer together. And perhaps certainly historically, men maybe turn to the drink. They tend to keep things into themselves rather than come along saying, I have a depressive illness. But I think things are easing to a degree that men are more likely to come forward with anxiety, with depression. And one thing I think has helped there is that people now are aware of, say, post-traumatic stress, including a lot of, say, soldiers. I mean, these are supposed people put themselves on the line, risking their lives, Iraq, Afghanistan, elsewhere. And everybody now recognises that they have psychological problems. So men now feel, well, look, if these really tough guys putting their lives on the line in a war zone are able to say psychology is very important, well, then maybe it's okay for me to say it as well.
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. Which now leads us into sort of a more contemporary period that that the whole population involved in, Philip, and this is the COVID-19 crisis that we're all experiencing. There have been much discussions around the mental health impacts. I mean, how do you view the current situation in terms of COVID-19 and mental health impacts?
Well, the first thing I'd want to say that there are at times we have been seeing fake news around regarding an increase in suicide, and that is definitively not the case. There have been a lot of alarmist headlines, and the evidence from very close analysis, both UK-wide but also worldwide, happily, suicide has not increased to date as far as we know.
Yeah.
Now, there clearly is an increase in mental distress, but of course, mental distress would cover both psychiatric illness and the general distress any of us would have in these very, very difficult times. And indeed, in the early months, there would have been a reduction in people presenting to services. But over the last 9 months, as we have moved toward perhaps a slightly more normal situation, there clearly has been a significant increase in presentations.
Yeah.
There's also some anecdotal evidence, not definitive in terms of research, that maybe those who are prone to have drink problems beforehand are probably drinking more than they did before. And that certainly would be a concern.
Okay.
But again, the evidence is not absolutely definitive there. I myself would be of a view that there is a sense that even though it's gone on for a year, there's still a sense of we're all in it together. Everybody's complaining about not being able to go out to the pub and so on. And that degree can help. It means if I'm feeling down or depressed, everybody's feeling a bit like that.
Yeah.
I think we do need to watch out the next 2 to 3 years as things normalise. But there will be longer term impacts, not least arising from the economic effects of COVID. And to me, that will be the most important thing of all. And perhaps people who have deferred coming for help will come forward. And we don't want our services to be overwhelmed. Now, people need to come forward and get help. But I mean, the Royal College of Psychiatrists has been saying to, I think the Minister's been listening, say we would envisage the need for more support for people over the coming 1, 2, 3 years.
Okie dokes. Okay, so that was going to be my next question, what are the long-term issues we will have to face, and I think you probably answered that. Have there been any positive mental health issues or any issues, positive issues coming out of the crisis? In terms of us as individuals?
Yeah. Well, yes, we do know that technology has its ups and its downs. We know the ill effects of social media and what can happen on Twitter at times, but also it can be a real boon. And we've talked for years, haven't we, about making more use of technology. But now almost everybody has been able to use Zoom and other similar methods. And in fact, that has opened up possibilities that really we people hadn't really realized before. Now, this doesn't take away the need also to plenty of personal contact. Absolutely not. Hopefully in the future, we'll take the best of the enhancement of technology. And one big thing we've noticed is that I have an interest in interpersonal psychotherapy. It's a bit like CBT. It's sort of 12 to 16 sessions rather than very long-term therapy. But in the past, for psychotherapy, you had to arrange the person to come along to a fixed point where you would be, and maybe they would be have to drive to get there, get parked, come in to see you. You had to be there, and then and maybe another half hour getting home. Well, in fact, now you can do it easily online. And many of the psychotherapists are saying you're actually doing this much more efficiently than before. It also means that maybe there isn't a therapist right close by you. Well, then maybe there might be a therapist, maybe there's spare capacity in another trust, for example. And you don't have to drive 50 miles to them. They can do it online. So there are possibilities to be blended in with getting back to see people, because there's nothing like meeting people in the flesh, really.
Yes.
I mean, man's a social animal.
Yeah.
Or humans are social beings, so we need that. But maybe we can add on to that the benefits of the technology. I'd heard a patient yesterday who actually quite a quiet, isolated man. But in fact, suddenly he announced to the nurse seeing him, I've been doing yoga by Zoom over the last 3 months. Now, that guy, she said, he would never in his life have thought of going to a yoga class. He'd been far too shy.
Yes.
He's doing yoga by Zoom. Now, hopefully, then she'll try and encourage him. You can do it by Zoom. Why not try and get out and go to a local club? Let's see what you can do. And he's up for that now in a way he wouldn't have before.
Okay. Again, that sounds wonderful. It's most enlightening. Generally, Philip, I mean, if they think they're having difficulties during the present situation, I mean, if people think they have a mental health issue connected to COVID-19 or whatever, I mean, where should they go or what should they do about it?
Well, the first thing, as always, don't be shy. If you feel you need to get some advice, help, that's fine. And indeed, one perhaps benefit, again, of the system is that GPs are doing an awful lot of direct phone contact by patients, doing a telephone triage, and that's really working rather well generally. And it means you can talk to the GP, and in many cases might be able to say, look, I'm happy enough, there's nothing for you to worry about there, you've described your symptoms, here's a bit of general advice, give me a ring in a week or two if that's not working, you know. So as always, the GP is normally the first source of contact for any significant medical issue, whether mental health or psychological. We also in Northern Ireland, of course, have an extremely active voluntary sector, some very local organisations based in local communities, others on a much wider basis, and those work very well. And in fact, one of the themes I think we do need to work on is trying to bring together the statutory sector, the GPs and mental health service, and the voluntary sector. And hopefully in time, that is going to take place more. Mm-hmm. I've been involved recently in a working group for the Department of Health looking at crisis services. And one of our suggestions is likely to be finding a way of integrating better than before what the GPs and the mental health teams are doing, along with the voluntary sector. And that's a very positive possibility, I think, in the future.
Okay. Again, something good seems to be happening in this particular area. If I could, Philip, take you back to maybe to a previous life, and you were a politician at one stage, and maybe that's something you don't really want to face up to.
An amateur politician,
I think more so. I mean, how do you think that our, I mean, we'll take it our, well, we're going through a different difficult circumstance at the present time, but how do you think our local politicians have handled the crisis so far?
Well, I think Robin Swan has come out of this incredibly impressively, and there's nobody who would say he hasn't done an excellent job. He's a rather low-key, unflashy person, but in fact, maybe that was a character we needed, but incredibly solid and organised and meticulous. And to my mind, while politicians in certain other parties have been making a lot of noises off stage that have been extremely unhelpful, he has been steady Eddie, steady Robin. And I think we're very lucky to have had him. And as a consequence, despite, again, a lot of the noise that one sometimes may hear about on social media, or indeed in certain programs on the radio, in fact, I think the health service has done a very, very good job here. And I think Robin Swan has shown good leadership, as well as many, many other politicians, by the way, the vast bulk of whom have been very sensible and reasonable. You know, it's easy to look back with hindsight, oh, things could have been done slightly differently. And of course, there's always things we can learn. And I suppose some of the people sort of criticise, and it's easy to criticise politicians, what would you have done at the time?
Yeah.
More important thing is, I mean, there could be another pandemic in 10 years' time, 50 years' time, 100 years. Can we learn from this?
Yeah.
And I think if we're to learn something from this, the big thing is looking back over the last year, remember this time last year, Brian, the big concern was the need to get more and more ventilators.
Yeah.
We talked about the Nightingale hospitals.
Yes.
Now, if they hadn't prepared for more ventilators, which they did, and set up the Nightingales, the government quite rightly been hugely criticised. We had a situation like Italy of people in corridors not getting ventilators. That's fair enough. But in fact, they weren't really necessary. And it goes back to basic, good quality public health medicine. Prevention is better and, dare I say, cheaper than cure.
Yeah.
So if it was to happen again, you probably would be, dare I say, closing down the airport at an earlier stage.
Yes.
You can't go the full New Zealand stage.
No.
That's, Heathrow, for example, is one of the busiest airports on the planet. We accept that. But more of that prevention. And of course, if you can limit the number of cases in the early stage, you then do really rigorous tracing and tracking. And then making sure people isolate, but with enough support to make sure they can afford to do it rather than leaving it ad hoc. So it's a prevention. It's a bit like my idea back to home treatment is better than being in hospital. If they can prevent getting into hospital in the first place, that's a good thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I know some of my colleagues in geriatric medicine and the care of the elderly would see the model we use in home treatment to catch with something to look at, because it manages people in their own home, then they don't go into a nursing home whereby maybe, now the nursing home has done a fantastic job, but managing people home safely, and I know that, and some of our trusts, our geriatric colleagues, are developing home treatment, seeing people in their own home in the first place, which in fact would be a COVID spreader preventer by doing that kind of work.
Yes.
And people are being nursed, are being seen and treated in the company of their family, rather than taken away where at the time, the height of the epidemic, they couldn't even be visited.
Yeah.
So it's preventive care. Treating people in the least restrictive environment is a good thing in itself. And to me, COVID reinforces that.
Okay. I was going to ask you, would you have done anything differently? But I think you've touched on a few points. Is there any radical ideas, Philip, you might have been interested in or would suggest?
I think look, there are always some viruses endemic. I mean, even for example, there are, say, the actual plague bacillus is still endemic in certain parts of it, of China, for example. And then we go back to the Black Death and so on. So we have to assume, especially with much greater travel nowadays, that there will be epidemics of certain conditions and pandemics. So it's being prepared, it's international cooperation, it's sharing information. But finally, the vaccine program has been a huge success. There is no doubt about that.
Yes.
Except need to make sure it gets to the whole planet.
Yeah.
And it's not just for the rich countries.
Yeah.
It's been marvelous here.
Yeah.
And that really is opening things up. We look at India, which is a big producer of pharmaceuticals in itself. You know, and that's really sad. So that has to be worked out.
Right. Okay. Philip, what we're going to maybe do is just change the tact here. And I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast that you're in a kind of semi-retirement phase. What are your longer term plans in terms of retirement? Are you going to stay on doing a number of sessions, or are you going to move into maybe another area completely differently to what you've been doing?
Well, I was dragged back. I was asked a year ago to come back to provide some support to nursing staff in the assessment clinic, but I'm still doing it shorter term. For the longer term, I'd always planned to keep up my interest in interpersonal psychotherapy. We don't provide enough psychological treatments to patients in Northern Ireland. We're far behind England, which invested very heavily in it. And IPT is a therapy less well known than CBT, but it's as effective for depression and other conditions. As I say, it's 50 minutes a week, an hour a week for up to between 12, 16 sessions. And I'm an established trainer in it.
Yeah.
For the last number of years, I've been training people, both psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses, social workers. It's a great therapy. So I would intend to continue that. And I'm on the UK National Training Committee for that. But I was talking to colleagues in the Republic a couple of days ago how we can develop. So it's been involved in the kind of psychotherapy training is very important to me. Also, I suppose I've been involved in one or two in a project for the Department of Health. And I think this has maybe been involved in a few projects like that.
Yeah.
Not too much. I still want to put time up to enjoy enjoy not being on a 9-to-5 basis. But still, it's nice to keep yourself active, and hopefully I can contribute. I've been in mental health now. I've been a doctor now for nearly 40 years and a psychiatrist about nearly 39 years. So
yeah.
I think I've still have a few things to contribute.
Okay. Again, changing tact, we ask people on the podcast, what are your, I mean, do you have any, it can be any type of, you know, interest, social interest, fun interest outside of your professional life that you're interested in?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that after I retired, I did go to Australia, a friend in Melbourne and a friend in Sydney, and because if I retired last year, I wouldn't have gotten there, you know. And we would have enjoyed travelling a bit, and we did get to Morocco that year as well, and Venice, so I'm glad I had that. But at the end of the day, you know, it's always nice to come home.
Yeah.
So I did the A-level English, my favourite subject at school. I've been involved in a couple of extramural classes at Stramilis, one on Russian literature and also in Russian politics.
Right.
There was a wonderful book club, online book club, which was from New York, which went through War and Peace last year, 15 pages a day for 3 months, and then you put your tweet online, and obviously publishing a book on it. So I really enjoy more time for reading and so on. And also, as I've been known to write a few articles for the newspapers and do a bit of tweeting, I say.
Yeah.
An interest in public affairs is it's an addiction, I'm afraid. It's kind of in the blood. And
yeah.
While I certainly have no interest in active politics, I think I still have one or two things to say. Again, keep myself active is quite important, you know, both using the mind and occasionally I go for used to a bit of running, maybe less so than I used to now. But a good brisk walk is actually very good for you.
Exactly. And we're coming up to your final question. And again, it's a kind of rhetorical, well, but it's asking you, and not including your job that you do. I mean, most people say this, the job that I did was the job I always wanted to do. But if you had a dream job, what would it have been?
Well, when I was at school, say English was my favourite subject, and I must say I had thought, wouldn't it be nice to be a journalist? Now, I've got to say that my idea of being a journalist was probably more in the area, I wouldn't mind like writing a weekly column for a national newspaper,
yes,
rather than the very, very hard work. Although I've always been fascinated by foreign correspondents. I mean, Fergal Keane is the most amazing guy. I followed his career over a long time. So I had liked the idea of trying to communicate. And I suppose when I was chair of the Royal College in Northern Ireland for 4 years at one point, and I was quite involved at that time, did a fair amount of media work and trying to can help do the work of continuing to destigmatize mental health and communicate about it to the public and other people. So, yeah, so being a journalist, but it's been a nice job as a journalist, the more interesting stuff and being able to maybe signed off, maybe sort of write the case in editorial, really. So it's more of a fantasy job than reality, because journalists work very hard and it's less glamorous most of the time.
Yeah. Well, look, Philip, thank you so much for taking part in this podcast. I mean, maybe you might take up podcasting, Philip. I think you have an interest in that area as well. So, look, Philip, thank you very much. This will be going up online, and we will let everybody know when this will appear, and we'll keep in contact with you, Philip, okay?
Indeed. That's fine, Brian, indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
My pleasure to talk to you, indeed.
Cheers.